I'm not going to say much other than to introduce Dominic Schwartz from ABC TV, who's very generously given her time. And what a big news week it's been, hasn't it? I mean, everything's been happening. Clinton, the Queen, the Adelaide Festival, the car race coming up, and, of course, the South Australian Press Club. So, Dominic, please come up here and I'll leave it to you.
Colleagues, guests, as you know, our topic for discussion and debate this afternoon is immigration, asylum seekers and Australia Today. Who better to talk about this than a former refugee who knows from experience the difficulties facing new arrivals? Tuong Kong Lu, the head of SBS Radio, is one such person. In 1975, Kong fled Vietnam after the fall of Saigon. He spent 3 days drifting on a raft in the Gulf of Thailand in unimaginable conditions until rescued. He spent the quarter of a century since then working tirelessly for a cohesive and harmonious society for all Australians, along the way notching up a very distinguished career. Kong was the first Vietnamese-born barrister admitted to the bar in Australia and was the first refugee to occupy the position of State Director of the Department of Immigration and Multicultural Affairs. Under his leadership since 1989, SBS Radio has grown into a national network on air and online, broadcasting to 68 countries, broadcasting in 68 languages, and bringing together Australians of all backgrounds. It's with great pleasure I introduce to you Tuong Kong Lu.
Thank you very much, Dominic. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, and particularly my colleagues in the media, and also the minister, Mr. Mark Brindell. I think I made a bad decision in the sense that I decided to go unscripted in front of you. I don't know whether it turned out to be a disaster or not, but I certainly will try. And the reason I decided to go unscripted because I thought this is the occasion that I should speak from the heart rather than from the mind, and that's why I did not write anything on paper. Perhaps I should start by telling some true stories and anecdotes that would illustrate the theme of today's discussion, that is the refugee and immigration debate. I was told this is a real story, that a grandparent of an Italian background, he came here just after the Second World War when the policy of the day was absorption, in the sense that you should try to become an Aussie, forget your language, forget your culture, and fit in like anyone else as much as possible. So naturally his outlook, even though with an immigration background, is that we should not do anything known as perhaps multicultural. We all Aussie and we have to be as much Aussie as possible. So he said so to his friends in the car. The point was that he did so, saying these things, while he was driving his grandson to an Italian language class. And the reason he encouraged his grandson to do that, because he saw the benefit, the economic benefit, in terms of a young Australian born of Italian background to be able to speak Italian in dealing with business with Italy, which is very much, as you know, a very strong economy within the European Union. So the point that we can draw from that story is that we all are living in multicultural Australia. Perhaps not many of us are aware of that, and perhaps even fewer of us might be able to make good use of it for benefit of Australia. If you look around your table, if you talk to people at your table, you may find that many of us certainly came to here from different backgrounds. In fact, at my table, as the committee member Robert Mann just said earlier, five out of 8 people sitting at a table came from a migrant background. So that's a reality that we're not conscious of most of the time. We conscious of it mainly with the debate, like the current one, in terms of the detention of people at Woomera, or in terms of the children overboard incident. That has brought the consciousness to the issue, and certainly for the sake of debating an important issue to Australia, I think that's not necessarily a bad thing, but we need to see it within the context. The fact that Australia is a multicultural society is a result of the immigration and refugee waves after waves coming to Australia. And as normally the case, the newer wave always receive criticism and sometimes receive hostile reaction. I know that there's our colleagues from the Adelaide Advertiser here in this room, and if you read back to the publication of the Advertiser or its predecessor in Adelaide, you will notice that perhaps in 1888 there were demonstrations in Adelaide against immigrants. You know who they were? They were the Irish Catholics. So the fact that the Vietnamese and the Indochinese came to Australia in 1975 receiving some hostility, and the fact that the Afghan, Iraqi and other brothers and sisters from the Middle East coming to Australia now receive some hostility is not new. It's just part of the process. It's just part of the normal reaction of a population, because if you don't know something, your first question used to be what I'm going to lose, rather than how we could make a benefit or derive benefit from a situation where we can help other people. The debate here now is happening at different levels by people ranging from those who are well informed to those who are not well informed. But nevertheless, I think it's important to have it, and nevertheless, I think it must be done in a rational way. I think there's good seminar on the economic impact of immigration, which took place in Canberra 2 years ago, and I don't, perhaps, there's no need for me to come into that details. And there was also another debate or another seminar which took place in Melbourne only a few days ago about the population or the future population of Australia, taking into account also the issue of refugee and immigrants. But I said earlier that I like to speak from the heart, so allow me also to tell you a little bit of myself and my experience. As Dominic was kindly to introduce me, I came here as one of the bold person. If you haven't seen one, you are seeing one now. I hope I look like a normal human being. But the fact that I was one of the boat people was very unconventional, in the sense that I did not have even a boat to be on. I escaped after the fall of Saigon, few steps in advance of the invading communist army, and I ended up in a very small island off the South Vietnamese coast in the Gulf of Thailand, where some fishermen were kind enough to let me use one of their raft, which is in the shape of a basket made of a bamboo and wax, so that the water could not get in. And there were the size of the boat or the size of the raft or the basket is not larger than the table you are at. And there were three of us, and the matter and the difference between life and death is about 3 inches above the water. I was the younger of the youngest of the three, so I had to take charge the unfortunate thing is that the basket is unsteerable, and there was strong wind and heavy rains and so on. So I had to bail out of water. After 36 hours, I was exhausted and desperate and demoralized. I could not see anything that is promising. So I started, we had with us a shortwave radio. So I started tuning in, and to my delight, I tuned in the BBC World Service. And I know that there are some ex-BBC journalists in this room too, so thank you very much for that. You know what my feeling was? I suddenly felt that I am reconnected with the living world outside myself. Because without that kind of intangible link, I might not have had the strength or the moral strength, the mental strength to survive. That shows one thing, and that is that the powerful, the marvelous strength of broadcasting, of radio. And Dominic said that perhaps I was destined to be with SBS Radio, which I'm very glad to have been for the last 12 years or so. SBS Radio is part of the SBS Corporation, and if you would allow me a few minutes of free ad, I'd just like to say a few words about SBS Radio, because that's also relevant to the debate of refugee and immigration issue. We're broadcasting in 68 languages, including English, and that's very important because that's a common language. And we started as a lifeline to Australians of culturally diverse background. And after 25, 26 years, we have gone a long way. We're now online. So from the very humble beginning, we were a lifeline to now, with technology, we're online. In other words, we are a mature broadcaster, but we haven't ceased to be the lifeline to most of our listeners, because our programs in a language or languages as a means to convey the kind of connection, reconnection of people from different backgrounds to the mainstream society in a less dramatic way than the way I tune in the BBC and felt reconnected to the living world. But nevertheless, it's very important. And also because we broadcast to a culturally diverse communities, we also have brought and are bringing them to the mainstream Australia to make sure that we are linking all the fabric of the Australian society together. Recently, during the Tampa issue, and recently also during the Woomera issue, SBS Radio provide programs that inform in an objective way our listeners and our viewers. And we hope that by doing that, we provide the ingredients for our listeners and viewers to understand the issue, to take part in a debate in an informed basis. Because with our SBS Radio, I'm sure that most of our listeners and viewers may not be able to participate into the debate, may not be able to feel that they're part of the community, because more or less, with our SBS Radio, they could become voiceless. They could become, or they could feel themselves marginalized. So from that point of view, SBS Radio plays a very important role in terms of providing the environment where a cohesive and harmonious society can be maintained or even can be enhanced. And we're doing so with broadcasters from many backgrounds serving Australian communities from cultural diverse environment. The challenge for us now is to ensure that we provide the objective information, because we always believe that SBS Radio is a forum for all views to be expressed and not a particular platform for any particular view, because we do believe that we live in a pluralist society and the choice and the objectivity is very important. Recently, when we celebrated the centenary of the Commonwealth of Australia. We have had the opportunity to go through the papers, the statements of many great Australians like Sir Henry Park, like Deakin, or from South Australia like Kingston. And great tribute had to be said vis-à-vis the achievement of those great people, the father of modern Australia. But we also have had the opportunity to reread the statements of many great leaders in Parliament when they considered the Immigration Restriction Bill 1901. And judging by the standard of contemporary Australia, many of us, I believe that many of you, surely could not accept the feelings or the arguments expressed. But certainly these feelings and the arguments are understandable, given the fact that Australia at that particular historical episode would have needed to accept that kind of approach to ensure the integrity of the Commonwealth, to ensure that all the states agree to stay in the Commonwealth, and to ensure that the population support the elected leaders. But while we understand those sentiments and those arguments, I don't think in contemporary Australia we can accept that kind of argument anymore. And that's why I believe that in 2002, there's no good economic reasons nor any moral justification for Australians like ourselves, or Australian or the man in this, or the person on the street, to adopt a very narrow focus, to look through the very narrow tunnel and to see nothing but a tiny white dot at the end. And I think that time is over. And because Australia now is a multicultural society, whether we like it or not, and because of the globalized economy, Australia cannot act in such a way that our founding fathers could in 1901. And I think with that perhaps thought, I do thank you very much for the opportunity. I know that there are other speakers, and I would be happy to join with my co-panelists, perhaps to attempt to answer some of your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Kwong, for your speech. Kwong was named one of the three Australian Achievers of the Year this year in a ceremony on Australia Day at Admiralty House in Sydney. He was accorded his award by the Prime Minister, John Howard. Dr. Andy Thomas was also named one of the Achievers as well, which of course we all know is important to those of us who live in Adelaide. I'd like now to introduce our panellists. If you could come up, please. Fahad Nouri, Mike von Berg and Russell Hamadi. And perhaps, Kwong, if you could join us up here too, that would be wonderful. I'm sure there are questions that people would like to ask you. What I'll do is I'll give a brief introduction to each of these people and then open up the floor to questions. As per usual, if people could identify themselves, who they're working for, we do ask maybe that members of the working media have priority at this stage, and we'll open it up later for other questions. Next to Kwong is Fahad Nouri. He was born in Iran. He was 80 years old when the Islamic Revolution dramatically changed his life. His family suffered religious persecution because they were members of the Baha'i faith. 200 followers of the Baha'i were executed. Fahad's parents were sacked from their government jobs and his uncle was jailed for 15 years. Baha'is were denied university access and passports. Fahad's family sought the only way out for their son. They paid a people smuggler to take him to Pakistan. Unfortunately, he was arrested on the Iranian border and jailed. And he was jailed on charges of spying for Israel, which in Iran is not a good thing to be jailed for. He fled Iran a year later and was recognised as a refugee by the United Nations in Islamabad. A year after that, in 1988, he arrived in Australia alone, aged 17. Farhad won a scholarship to study in the United States, but returned to become an Australian citizen. He's currently working with the Australian Refugee Association, assisting new arrivals in gaining employment. Please welcome Farhad Noori. Next to Farhad is Russell Ahmadi. He was born in Mazar-i Sharif in northern Afghanistan. He studied English literature at university and travelled to Pakistan in 1998, seeking to obtain a scholarship which might enable him to travel overseas to further his studies. While there, the Taliban took control of his hometown. He had no way of knowing if his family had been injured or killed in the assault. As his brother was a commander of a Shia militia, which was opposed to the Taliban, it was unsafe for him to return. Rasul applied to the United Nations in Pakistan for refugee status, but he was denied that status. Luckily, he'd worked in Mazar as a translator for Australian journalists and members of the Australian non-government organisations. He contacted these people and they acted as his referees and support to finally allow him to be granted official refugee status. He arrived in Australia in April 1999. He's since worked as a cleaner, a volleyball umpire, in a laundry, a carpet shop with Mitsubishi, and most recently, again, as an interpreter. Please welcome Russell Ahmadi. And bringing up the rear, in no way is that a bad thing, is Mike von Berg. Mike von Berg grew up in Bavaria during the Second World War. His was a well-to-do family, his mother a doctor, his father a nobleman and opera singer. But the family lost everything during the war, and in the European winter of December 1949, they boarded the Fairsea for the journey to Australia. They wound up at the Bonegilla migrant camp in the baking heat of summer. It was tough for a German lad in Lederhosen at an Irish Catholic school eating smelly Metwurst sandwiches. And having eaten those smelly Metwurst sandwiches at Clapham Demonstration Primary School many years later, I also had a bit of a problem. It must have been much worse for Mike. But Mike says it taught him how to look after himself and it taught him how to fight. He went on to join the Australian Army and served in Vietnam, for which he was awarded the Military Cross, but only after a very hasty infield naturalisation ceremony. He went on to establish a career in international banking, then switched his attention to the wine industry, where he's worked for some of the big-name companies, including Hardee's. He's currently an agribusiness consultant. Please welcome Mike von Berg. Maybe before I get people to come up, if I could perhaps just throw a general question and get all of you to give a quick reply to it as a way of kicking off the discussion. Do you think, gentlemen, at this stage, that the sort of response we're seeing to asylum seekers now is just it's typical of the hard time that all immigrants are given when they first come to Australia, or are we being particularly intolerant this time round? From your own experiences, please. Maybe starting with you, Kwong. If you'd like, you can either use that or come up here, whatever you feel comfortable with.
I think certainly there are similarities and differences in terms of the reaction of the Australian population relating to different waves of migrants and refugees. Throughout the history, whenever we have a new wave of migrants, as I said earlier, even the Irish Catholics, who are now part of mainstream, were subject to hostility in Adelaide and many other parts of Australia. And the Indo-Chinese in post-1975 received more or less the same degree of hostility. But throughout the history, the reaction of elected leaders can be or could be different at a time, at different stage of the development of Australia as a nation. Say, for example, in 1975, while there were some degree of hostility, community leaders and non-government organizations and governments at all levels seem to agree that the Indochinese had to be assisted and helped as much as possible. And in a sense, the governments of the day at all levels, Commonwealth, state and local, seem to be ahead of the feeling of the community. Now, if we look at the current situation, obviously there are similarities in the sense that historically there's always hostility to new waves of migrants and refugees. But I think the difference is now, in 2002, and that is because the magnitude of the issue, the magnitude of the problem, there are more than 20 million people in need of assistance, or 20 million people in search of asylum. And it's quite natural for people to think that if we assist 500 or 5,000, we certainly cannot solve the problem. And the problem would need to have perhaps an international effort, of which Australia play its part. And that's one difference. The other is also because we are living now in a much, perhaps, smaller world because of the globalization of the economy, because of the globalization of many other issues, and also because of, perhaps, we're far more interdependent to one another than we used to be. And because of those changes, which were not available, which were not relevant in many decades ago, in the last century, so the issue become more difficult. And you can say that because of these things, perhaps the Australian population can be, in a sense, less tolerant than they used to be. But that's because of we are living in a different age and different time. I would not say that the Australian society is worse, because I do believe that Australian society is in fact better. Only the issue would need to be seen and to be discussed in a rational manner. When you look at the refugees or asylum seekers and you term them as illegal migrants or queue jumpers, then in the abstract, inevitably, we conclude that they are bad people. But the fact of the matter is that many of them are in fact genuine refugees. And if you confront, if you face one of them face to face, you will see that they're just human beings like ourselves. And certainly, I think if Australian, a member of the Australian community, has that kind of experience, they would see things differently. I don't know whether I answered your question, Dominic, but I do feel that Australian society is in fact better than it used to be.
Thank you, Kwong. And Fahad Nouri. Maybe Fahad, because I'm always changing my mind anyway. One interesting thing about Fahad, of course, is that his parents sought the help of people smugglers to bring him out to Australia. In the end, that didn't work. But, of course, we all know that people smugglers have been portrayed as the great evil in the wave of asylum seekers coming to Australia. I'm sure it would be interesting for people here to know how you feel about people smugglers. And is that who we should be attacking, or is there some other root of the problem?
I feel more confident standing up and speaking. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your time that you have dedicated to delve into this issue a lot further than some of our fellow citizens in this country are being made aware of. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the land that we're standing on as the Kaurna people's land, the traditional inhabitants of this country. I do this not just to be trendy or being in the a politically correct sense. I'd just like to highlight the fact that we all here are guests and have come from different parts of the world, barring if there are any Aboriginal people in this room. Not long ago, a group of boat people arrived here With them, they brought guns. They had felons. They had people that were criminals by nature. And they landed on this shore, and they started to use Australians as target practice. Now, that happened not long ago. It's been documented, and we're spending 200 years trying to come up with a good apology when we haven't been succeeding in it. I just wanted to say that Australia has been providing a land of opportunity since then for many other peoples around the world to provide rather a shelter for people that have been fed up with the way that they have been treated. Now, United Nations in 1951 had a convention, and signatories to that convention, including Australia, agreed that if your human rights is being abused based on your race, religion, nationality, or basically personal beliefs, that you're able to go to another country and be given refuge or asylum. That's a given right by the nature of the United Nations trying to come up with a better world for us. Now, some countries have been standing by that promise, and some countries have been changing their mind, and some countries that did not sign with that, they have been having much better records than Australia has had of recent. You mentioned how my parents paid some smugglers to give me an opportunity to have a future. I had not spent even one night away from either of my parents, not even in school camp. I was not allowed to go because it was unsafe to be away. So I was coming from a very well protected family background, but yet I was put in a position to choose between joining the army and fighting a war. At the time, war between Iran and Iraq was on, and I had no choice to be able to join, get into university and not participate. And the ludicrousy of joining a war that I could not relate to, nor could a lot of my classmates, and yet they still had to join. It made them to come to a point that seek the only way out instead of having me trapped inside the house and virtual home detention. They paid lots of money, equivalent of two brand new cars, to a smuggler to take me across the border. Now, that smuggler that I met a few days prior to my departure came across not as an evil man. He said, "I'm here to give you a future, and I'll take you to a place of opportunities when there are lots of girls." And as a 15-year-old, that didn't necessarily strike a chord. Maybe I had a late puberty, but the land of opportunity side of things sort of was interesting. That he said, "Oh, you can listen to any music you want," and that again, you know, made me more interested. It just goes to show that when you're living in a closed society, simple things in life become such delicacy and materials, even though we did have the underground ways of getting to know what's going on outside our country. But getting back to the idea of the smuggler and how I was feeling internally about paying somebody to do something illegal, morally based on my own and family upbringing, initially I had problems with, but then I realized that if the world was in a better place, I did not have to do this. I could just walk across the border, go to a different country, come back, or catch a plane. As you would do, you know, you want to go and see Melbourne or Sydney, you know, you just travel interstate. Now, somehow we have come up with the idea of, no, we put our pegs in here first, let's build a wall around this country, and not let anybody else in. And that's overlooking the idea of we live on this planet as one society, whether we have different racial backgrounds or not. That's a point that could be discussed later. But after...
Yeah, I'm just keeping an eye on the time.
I wrap up and I tell you about the smuggler that you want to hear about. Well, I tell you one thing about smugglers. Smugglers are there to make money. They're not there to save the world. The way they do it is very simple. When I was caught on border prior, he said, "Don't tell anybody that who I am, because I'll get you out of prison after 24 hours. So 15 of us that were arrested, we just came up with different stories, and we kept getting slapped around for 24 hours. And it turned after 70 days, we finally gave up, and they couldn't hold us any longer. And if you ask people who are on boats, they would tell you that the smugglers are their guardian angels. Some of them would say that. And some of them would say they're the most horrible person they met. But they were a vehicle. They were a mean to an end, not the aim. The best way to get rid of them is to provide that opportunity for people to be able to come to this country in a much more approachable way than we have succeeded in the past.
I've just had a look at my watch and realised we have 20 minutes to go, so I suppose trying to give people a bit of a taste of what these people have to offer and then quickly questions. So, Rasul, maybe if you could just briefly perhaps, you got here on the strength, it would seem, of being able to have Australian contacts who could work for you. I'd be interested to know, do you think you would have had any chance of coming as a legal migrant had you not had those links? Perhaps if you could just briefly explain for us. Thank you.
Well, I was really panicking when I saw this gentleman talk for so much long time, and I thought, well, I can never do that, but thanks to Dominic, I can feel better now. But I do know that I should thank everybody here, especially the SA Press Club, to invite me for that. And I would like to thank every Australian in Australia especially, and all my friends who have helped me come to Australia. And briefly, to the answer the question that Dominic has asked, I don't actually think that I would have had any chances of coming to Australia without being helped by these friends that I met before in Afghanistan when I was working for them. As a local person, or as a person who doesn't know anyone abroad, or especially in Australia, it's really difficult to come to Australia if you don't have any money. And a person like me, who didn't have even $1 in pocket when I was in Pakistan, I was thinking of going back to Afghanistan and accepting all those dangers that I had faced before and continue with my life back in there. And who knows what could have happened. And I actually didn't have a telephone number for any of these friends. I didn't have any number for Christopher Kramer, who is a journalist, and I was interpreting for him when I was back at home in the north city of Afghanistan, Mazar-e-Sharif. I had a telephone number for an NGO, a charity organization worker who I used to work with in Afghanistan, and I tried that number. I thought it might help. Could be somebody else who can give me the number, or they could be the right people. But luckily, they answered the phone, and as soon as they heard that I was on the phone, they almost cried and said that they were very thankful to God that I was alive, because they had heard that a lot of people in the city where I was living had been killed. Sorry for that news. I know some people are eating. But these friends, they are called Harbinson family, Harbinson, Gresham, Ruth, and Brett. They are now working as a development worker. I mean, Brett is working as a development worker in Bangladesh, in the same area that he used to work. These friends helped me find the telephone number for Christopher Kramer. They actually called him, and he came over to Pakistan to meet me and meet with the United Nations officers and the Australian embassy workers in Islamabad. And these things all paved the way for me to come to Australia. And at the end, I can tell that I wouldn't have any chances of coming to Australia without the help of these friends. And I hope that answers the question. Thank you very much.
feel a bit like the stalker here. Mike, I understand you want to sit there. Now, you were telling me earlier, Mike spent some time at Bonegilla migrant camp, but it was quite a different place from Woomera and the other detention centres where a lot of people spend their time these days. I understand there was no barbed wire and you were processed fairly quickly. I'm just wondering your experience and how you think that might have made your transition
easier. Yes, I think the real issue is that when we hit Bonegilla, we'd left Bremerhaven in Germany at minus 10. We hit Melbourne at probably 40 degrees and in a non-air-conditioned train on a narrow gauge up to Bonegilla. But the thing that's noticeable in terms of that particular camp, which were just igloo huts, the old igloo huts, steel, was the fact there was no barbed wire. There was no perceived internment or curtailment. But everybody that was there wanted to be here, and everybody that was there had gone through a due process. Now, in fact, in our particular case, it took us 2 years to apply and to be accepted and to finally come over. I find it bizarre in terms of the way that the matter is being handled at the moment. I mean, I used to be more right-wing than Genghis Khan. I'm now slightly left of centre. But I find it bizarre in terms of the way that we're handling this problem. But with all due respect to the internees, I also find it very bizarre in terms of the way that they are handling the problem. I mean, we had people in Bonegilla. We were lucky. We got out in 3 months. I hadn't had any meat until I was 7 years of age, and the first piece of meat that I ever had was mutton and three veg, and it wasn't too pleasant. But we didn't complain, because we saw it as a new opportunity, a new start, a new chance in life. And what we did do, we adhered at that particular time to the laws of the land. There were no riots, there was no hostility. Mind you, we didn't have guards, we didn't have barbed wire. And we got on with our lives, and we just waited our turn until we got out. But I think, again, we're going back in terms of the way the situation is being handled, I think we're handling it very badly, and I think also the internees are handling it very badly. And when you come to this country, you adhere to the laws of the land. And if you don't adhere to the laws of the land, you should be penalised.
Do we have any questions from the floor? Well, while someone's coming up to the microphone... Yes? For sure, please. And if you don't mind, just introducing yourself for our guests.
Firstly, to the panel, you might be interested to know that in my small street where I live, more than half the residents come from overseas, from 5 countries on 4 continents, and in myself, although my European appearance, I was born very close to where Kwong was. Very close, actually. But my question is, how ironic does the panel see it that when the Indo-Chinese came here, they came from horrific times, they came these horrific boat journeys, and I've heard many accounts of them, and they came here and they were readily admitted, presumably mainly because the Australians were so much intimately involved in Vietnam. Now, how ironic with today, I don't think anyone here would believe in an open gate policy, you admit everyone, but how ironic do you feel that when the Iranians, the Iraqis and the Afghans come here after horrific experiences in their countries, horrific boat journeys, that they're immediately bundled into detention centres. In my table someone said, don't use concentration camps. Centres, because there's no comparison to what the Nazis did to people, but in detention centres, behind barbed wire, the children too, the mothers too, and for the so-called due processing, not 3 months in the case of Bonegilla, but in many cases a year, even 18 months or more. How ironic do you see the comparison?
Sure. I just thought I jump on the chance because I feel I'm the only person on this panel that has been inside Woomera, probably in this room as well. I don't know, half of the room is full of journalists. How many of you have had requests to go to Woomera? How many have been in the Woomera? You have been to Woomera, sir. Okay, that's excellent. That's much more than the response I get. Well, you can relate to this. When you enter Woomera, it's 6 hours outside Adelaide, the facilities there is nothing that you can't create just about 15 minutes outside Adelaide. But for some reason, it is out there. Many layers of barbed wire, 20 feet high, the height of this ceiling. And of course, still can't keep people in if somebody wants to break out. As we have heard, there have been a couple of cases of breakouts. But one thing that struck me as I was traveling in with a group of lawyers, after passing the prohibited area, there's a big sign saying, "Welcome to Woomera Reception and Processing Center." And about 15 feet above that sign, I saw I don't know if you can relate to this, but when I was a kid, we were making kites out of paper and a couple of sticks. I saw this kite, exactly the same design as I would make as a kid with the chain hanging around it, stuck in this barbed wire and pieces of string with four different colors every 2 or 3 meters tied up together. And we followed the line, and there were about 6 kids trying to untangle this kite and were ripping it to shreds. And I think that just encapsulates the atmosphere that goes on inside there and how it would make them feel. There were lots of kids, adults, families, and it's you use the word ironic. I think it's rather appalling the way that asylum seekers are being treated, particularly because of the point that 96% of the asylum seekers get released, get recognized as refugees. Now, the people that you would see next week on your street were being treated as criminals for up to a year prior to that, and for 96% releases of Afghan community that I'm dealing with, I think the way that we're treating them is somewhat leaves room for improvement, least to say. And I'm just worried that, you know, we haven't learned from many of our lessons, and I'm concerned about how many lawsuits is going to come up after they're given granted their citizenships and apologies. As you have seen, how do the parents feel that they were being labeled throwing their children into the water, and those kids would say, "Mom, Dad, did you throw me in the water when I came here?" And how would you think that they were going to respond to that?
Okay. Anyone else like to respond to the question? No more takers? Mike, did you want to say something briefly?
Oh, no, look, I think the real issue here, without getting too emotional about it, is the fact that it's a different era and it's a different time. And I think the other issue, of course, is that there's a lot of September 11 paranoia at the moment, which we can't ignore, and it's just very unfortunate in terms of what has happened at this particular time.
Yes. Good afternoon. My name's Yvonne Moore, and I've been working as an activist in the population stabilisation movement for 12 years. I've got a question for Mr. Tuong Quang Lu. Given current demographic trends, if they continue, we'll see white Australians, that is Anglo-Celtic Australians, become a minority by the year 2050. Can you understand the uneasiness among many white Australians about this trend, given the way that minorities are treated in all countries around Asia, and the Chinese would have a very good understanding of poor treatment?
Well, I'm not sure whether I fully understand your question, but if I can just restate it so that I could understand you better. You said that with the current trends in the population, Australia would be predominantly perhaps Asian, or the white Australian would become minority in their own country. Is that something what you're saying? Yeah, I understand. I don't think, to start with, I'm not sure whether the assumption is correct. There are a lot of studies in terms of the racial background of Australians, and there's a very good, there's a series of good paper by an academic at the ANU, point to the fact that as of this stage, the proportion of Australian with some quote unquote Asian background would not more than 5% or so, 5 to 7% of the Australian population. And as you know, there's a lot of intermarriage between communities. So I don't think that even in the 2050, that is about 50 years from now, the Australian society from the racial point of view would be basically different from what it is now. That's my assumption. And my assumption on the basis of the study already done. Because I do believe that Australia, as a multicultural society, does have the opportunity to absorb, even within that so-called multicultural parameters, of the descendants of migrants and refugees. They're very good examples standing in front of you. This is my very able chairperson of the meeting today, Dominic. Dominic is sixth generation Australian, but her ancestors came from an area border Polish and German area. And you look at her, she's a marvelous Australian.
Gee, I'm going to get him to write a reference.
So what I'm saying is descendants of migrants and refugees, and I can assume that, I can claim that, unless we have an indigenous Australian in this room, unless we have one, if we don't, then I can say to all of you, to all of us, that we are all descendants of migrants and refugees. The first fleeters were, in fact, both people. And as you see, this is a marvelous society. There's no reason for me to be pessimistic insofar as 2050 is concerned, insofar as the Australian mix of the population is concerned.
We probably have time for one more question, if anyone has a question. Right, well, I suppose then what we'll do is we'll wrap it up, and I'm sure that there might be people who approach you on a one-on-one basis afterwards. So please give a round of applause to our guest, Michael von Berg, Farhad Nouri, Rasul Ahmadi, and Trong Kong Lu.
Thank you very much, Dominic. You're allowed to go and have a glass of red, but no more than one, because you've got to read the TV news tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming along. I found that both informative, stimulating, and indeed moving, I think, because it's only when you put a human face on these things that you get a feeling for really what it's all about. You can read it in the papers and see it on the screen, but when it comes home to people being in leaky boats in the ocean, it puts a whole new dimension on it. So thank you very much to all of our panel, and in particular to Dominique. Now, I'm going to get Sue Fraser to come up a moment and do the raffle. But first of all, I have the very pleasurable duty of presenting our key guest speaker with our traditional gift, which is in fact a magnum of Orlando's wonderful St Hugo 1993 Coonawarra Cabernet Sauvignon. And I hope I'm not going to offend any other sensibilities when I present our other guest speakers with a bottle of the red wine you enjoyed at lunch. I'll speak a few words about that in a moment. If you can't drink it, please give it to someone who'll enjoy it. Like me. The committee was running this club, some of the members of the committee wanted to economise on wine, and I said, apropos of Groucho Marx, who said any club will have me as a member I don't want to belong to, I said I'm not going to belong to any club that drinks bad wine. And I think you'd agree that we've always drunk good wine, and that's largely thanks to our sponsor Orlando Wyndham,
I have no particular extra grant for them other than gratitude for providing us with some very good wines at some very good prices. And I thought that the wines today, particularly the red wine, the Jacobs Creek Reserve Shiraz, is a terrific wine, very good value. Mark Brindle was asking me how much it cost. It's about $13 or $14, Mark, and it's good value. So, gentlemen, I hope you enjoy it. Okay, Sue, all yours. Yeah, we've got one more. Where is it? Judith? Yep. Dominique's bottle, where is it? Oh, good. It's been slipped in your hands. Good. Enjoy it.
Okay. Okay. Have you got your raffle ticket out? Simon Yeoman, come on up here and draw the raffle. Come on, Simon. You all know Simon. Judith, would you be so kind as to hand up our prizes? Okay, hold on to that blossom. Give him a good stir. I did give him a good stir at the table. Okay, do you all know Simon Yeoman, journalist for The Advertiser? Famous man. Okay, we've got the Telstra cordless, Panasonic cordless telephone. That's the right one, isn't it? Uniden cordless phone from Telstra. Which we all would love. Who has won that, Simon? Away you go.
Blue 11.
Blue 11?
Blue A11.
Blue A11. Whoa! Here we go. We have a carton of the West End 107 Pilsner, thanks to SA Brewing. Simon?
Purple.
B17, purple. Oh, there's a name written on that. Can we read that? Something like Farad. Not here. You! Wow! I thought it was as soon as I saw it. Fantastic. You're a real Aussie now. Hey. A real Aussie now. Okay, we have another carton of the West End 107 Pilsner.
Purple B34. John somebody? John.
It's John somebody with a G. John G. Purple B. Over there? Julie. It's Julie Green. Oh, we can't read that, Julie. Julie Green from Australia Post. There we go. You've got to cart that all the way back to work. And finally, Rex's big prize from The Advertiser, Sunday Mail, his multi-purpose Sunday Mail advertiser pocket knife. Trust Rex to send us a knife when he's not here.
That's Chris Chalk.
Chris Chalk. Chris Chalk, sitting at my table over there. Chris Chalk. There we go. Thank you all for your attendance here today. Thank you very much to our panel. We really appreciate it and hope to see you at a press club luncheon soon. Thank you.